Hey everyone, this is Dina Jones, one of the founders of Joe Bean Roasters. At Joe Bean, our mission, Coffee That Lifts Everyone, is about giving selling power back to coffee farmers, as well as purchasing power into the hands of our customers. Through our network of farmers, we're able to bring you naturally grown, amazing coffee directly. Our long-term farming partners negotiate pricing based on cost of production, as well as quality of product, not on fluctuating, unpredictable market prices. This enables them to create thriving businesses with bright futures. And our customers get empowered knowing exactly who grows their coffee and how, as well as knowing they are a part of a new, sustainable, global coffee network. To try our coffee, go to JoeBeanRoasters.com and be sure to check out our Perpetual Joy coffee subscription to receive a rotating selection of single-origin coffee delivered right to your door. Thank you to all our Rochester friends who have supported us and our farming partners so wonderfully over the years. You are making a difference with every bag.
Good morning. Thank you so much for listening to the 200th episode of the podcast. Now, I do think that there may be, due to the nature of today's podcast and the guest and the high-profile celebrity guest on today's show, I have a feeling some people may be listening to this who probably didn't listen last week, so I am going to repeat something from last week about the 200th episode, because again, if you follow this podcast at all, you might be going, what is he talking about? Didn't he just do his 100th episode like 2 weeks ago? So I have gone ahead and made this extra confusing for you. The interview that I did with Brother Weeze was the 100th interview on this podcast. Today is the 200th episode. I don't know why I've decided to separate the two. Like I said, it's confusing, and I've screwed the whole thing up. And so what I'm thinking of is actually doing is, starting with today, maybe I just make it right, and starting today, there's no more separation between interview and episode. It's just, this is the 200th episode. Next week will be 201, whether it's a monologue or a guest, right? That's what I think. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. I do appreciate you. I will make this intro very quick because we're all here for the same reason, and that is to hear from the legend. I mean, geez, between Brother Weeze and Don Alhart, like two broadcast legends in just a few weeks on this podcast, I just count my lucky stars. I count my blessings that I'm lucky enough to know these people. It's no secret how I know Brother Weeze, but the way that I know Don Alhart is that he is a Rotarian, and I am a Rotarian, and we belong to the same Rotary Club. And that's how I got to know Don, you know, well. I wouldn't say I know Don well. We're not besties or anything. But what I mean is that, of course, I knew of Don prior to joining Rotary, and you know, like anybody knows Don, but I have actually gotten to spend more time around him and work on some committees with him and get beyond just the pleasantries and actually get into some real stuff over the years. And I just, again, count my lucky stars that I can call him a friend and hopefully soon to be, as a past Rotary president, also a mentor, as I am the incoming Rotary president. Anyway, thank you so much for listening, and without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy my interview with the man who will retire after 58 years on the air, although we do discover during this podcast that it's actually more like 62 years in the business, 58 years maybe on the air. Ladies and gentlemen, Hall of Famer, legend, Don Alhart. otherwise you get people.
Can you hear me all right? You
know, yeah. Does it drive you crazy when you're? I hit record, by the way, so we're officially. Does it drive you crazy when you're at an event and somebody is just off mic? They start talking like this, and nobody tells them.
Kelvin House does it every week. Just the moment he won't. Of course, the one time I tried to judge the mic, the whole thing fell over. So.
Well, Don, thanks for doing this. Yeah. Thank you very much for doing the podcast. I really appreciate this. It's beautiful to come to your home, but isn't it? This is a newer home for you, right? Didn't you guys move out of your house a couple years ago?
Yeah, it's been 7 years now. Hard for us to believe. 7 years ago, we made the move to what we call right size. Yeah. We weren't really ready to downsize and give up all of the space that we've been used to. But I think we realized that you need to plan ahead. You need to anticipate where you're going to be in the next 5 to 7 years at times. And we looked around and we've been Penfield for over 40 years. Yeah. Penfield at the time didn't have the right downsize dimensions that we were looking for, so we ended up here right next to Locust Hill, where we.
Well, I wasn't going to give away your exact location. Yeah. I feel bad.
We're in the neighborhood.
I was going to say you're bad. Like, all right, now.
So it gives us a chance to.
You're a celebrity. We can't tell them it's all right. All right. You guys love Aruba, right? Yeah. We were just upstairs having coffee cake with Mary. And I have a theory that I think that I understand because of how long I was around Brother Wheeze, that I wonder if people get it. But I just want to know if I'm right. Do you love going on vacation because you get the chance to be anonymous?
Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah. Although even now in Aruba, there are so many people from the Rochester area.
Yeah,
there are people from Rochester now wherever you go. I remember years ago, Dick Burt, when I was co-anchoring with him, was going to New York City with one of our producers to do a story. And he made a bet. He said, I will bet you within the first 1 hour of the plane landing, three people will come up to me. And the producer said, no way that's going to happen. No way. And sure enough, the plane landed. Dick Burt, between the time they went from the airport to the hotel, three or four people had come up and said, I know you. I'm from Rochester. I've seen you. So I will get people even in Aruba now, and not necessarily people who live here now. I will get people to say, I went to RIT 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember you. It gives you some relief. I think, part of it is just, I forget even here that anyone knows who I am.
Yeah, because you do kind of just walk into the room all the time without... It does seem you kind of throw caution to the wind on the whole fact that people are constantly tugging on you, saying, hey, Don.
And that's, I think that's, in a way, I think that's part of probably the success I've had, because it's never really dawned on me in a real sense that when I walk in, people are like, I notice it. I will, I'll walk into Wegmans, and I can tell when people recognize me. Some people come up, some don't.
Do you ever feel bad?
My favorite story, and this is 20 years ago, so I was younger and younger looking, but and that made it more funny at the time. But I was out in Henrietta at the McDonald's, and I'm driving through. It's on my lunch hour, and I get to the first window, and I place my order, and I can tell that the young lady recognizes me. And, that's flattering. You got that little, they know who I am. I get to the second window. There's five or six people there. And they're all, and I'm puffed up. I'm thinking, this is, and the woman goes, I can't believe it. Bob Barker came to my McDonald's.
Yes.
And that brought me right back down to where I belong. So I always keep that Bob Barker in the back of my head a little bit. So when I walk around, they'll know. Maybe it could be Bob Barker.
Even in Rochester, does it ever happen to you? I guess you just told a story where it happens to you, but does it ever happen to you where you're at a dinner party, anything, where there's kind of the, so what do you do for a living?
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, do you ever have you ever been asked in the last 10 years by somebody in Rochester, so Mary's husband, what do you do for a living? And you're kind of like, well, I do TV news.
I had one person come up to me once and this woman had said, did anyone ever tell you you look like Don Elhart? Now, that's a tough question to answer. Did anyone ever tell you you look like Don Elhart? And I said,
that's tough.
I said, well, yeah. I said, actually, I am. And she said, no, you're not.
Yeah,
and impossible. She walked away. She didn't believe that it
she
was.
She probably thought you were a jerk. She's like, that guy's pretending to be Don Elhart. What the hell?
Trying to think. I mean, especially younger people now, because the people that obviously identify with me have you know, over 58 years, you have a chance to kind of carry that audience with you. So I think a lot of our success at Channel 13, at least for me, has been the, you know, I wasn't quite in the baby boom. I think I'm a year or two older than the baby boomers, but that baby boom generation kind of latched onto me and carried through. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I don't pay attention to ratings now. I think we're still number one. But if we are, it's probably that older part. I always hear that word. Well, we need to get a younger demographic. We need to get the young people. So while we may be number one overall, I think a lot of it is that audience that kind of just carried through.
Sure. Yeah. Do you ever think to yourself when you reflect on your career and think, thank God I got in at the time I got in?
I probably have used that phrase more as people ask me about retirement, saying I am so grateful for the window of broadcasting that I had.
Yeah.
And that's really the very beginnings of television. I mean, when I was a kid, it was radio. That's all we had.
Yeah.
My brother and I would climb. We lived on Culver Parkway, just over the line in Irondequoit from the city. My dad had an appliance store on Culver and Grand Avenue, and we lived in the Merchants Road area. And the highlight for us at night was to go up to his bedroom, lay on the bed, and turn on the radio, listen to the Lone Ranger, listen to radio, you know, dramas. And it was probably 1949, because again, my dad had an appliance store. We got one of the first televisions, a console as big as they have now with a screen about 7 inches wide. But it, you know, it didn't even come on the air until 4 or 5 in the afternoon with Howdy Doody. And we would watch that in black and white. And so that was, you know, the very beginning. So my life kind of embraces the start of television. You know, and by the time I was in fifth grade, when one of our teachers built a radio station in the corner of the room as a project, and my best friend and I just said, this is neat. And when he took it down, we went home and built radio stations in our bedrooms, got a reel-to-reel tape recorder, which I still have. If I turn that on now in our studio here, you would hear, you know, me and Pete Burrell, when we were probably in fifth or sixth grade, doing a radio show, because we knew then from that moment that's exactly what we wanted to do.
So you break in, and someday you're the first, it's your first day, you're the new kid, right? Yeah. And you get this passion for news. How do you convince them to put you on the air? What's day one? Like, hey, give me a shot, man.
It was interesting because I had worked 3 summers. I had a fantastic opportunity right out of high school. I applied for what is now Channel 8. It was Channel 5 at the time. They were moving that summer from Channel 5 to Channel 8 to make room for Channel 13 here and Channel 9 in Syracuse. And I had a Skippy ice cream route. I was down Lyle Avenue with a scooter and the big freezer on the back, selling popsicles and fudgesicles, and hearing, you know, my housewives yell at me from the porch that I was waking their kids up with the bell ringing. But I'd applied to Channel 8 at the time. I said, I want a job. And they said, what are you applying for? I said, anything. I'll empty the ashtrays, because people smoked back then.
Yeah.
I'll clean. I'll pay you if I can just be in the building.
Yeah.
They called me up and said, we would like to hire you as a summer relief engineer.
Ooh.
All I had known from my, you know, friend and I building our little radio stations, I could cue up a record and turn on a microphone, but that was about it. By the end of that summer, I was in master control. I was in the film lab. I was running the studio camera for Tom Decker and Bob Mills. I was the audio engineer for Gary Smith, and it was AM, FM, and television. Mm-hmm. I did that for 3 summers. And the summer of 65, I said, I really want to do something on the air. Mm-hmm. So I applied for Channel 13. I think they had, back then we used to have live booth announcers, and they said, You don't have the right sound. You don't have the right timbre to be an announcer.
Wait, do you remember the guy that told you that?
I think it was Jerry Pearson.
Well, you didn't have to say it. I can't feel bad. You didn't have to say
he's gone.
I just wonder if that ever motivated
Jerry
you.
Jerry Pearson, he said, you don't have the right timbre. You don't have the right sound. But he said they have an opening in the news department. It doesn't matter as much down there. Go down there. So I go down to the news department, and they had 4 people at the time in the news department. Harriet Bishop was a reporter who had just gone to a job in Florida and went on to become Ann Bishop and have a tremendous career. And that was the opening for a reporter. And the news director, Ray Law, said, you know, we don't need someone for the summer. We need a full-time reporter. And I said, well, how about this? Hire me now. And I'll work for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. As you keep looking for your reporter, I'll fill the void. And when you hire them, I'm done. I'd rather work 4 weeks as a reporter on the air and see if this is a way I can fulfill my dream. And they said, well, fine. That was a win-win for them. They got to have someone run out and, you know, shoot film and cover stories. By the end of the summer, I was still there. They said, you sure you want to go back? And I said, yeah, I have one more year of college. I'd like to do that. Well, we can't give you any guarantees. I said, well, I'll take my chances. And I graduated June 4th, 1966, and 6-6-66 on Monday. We expanded the news department from 4 to 5 people, I think. And that, you know, the rest is history, as they say. But yeah. But that was, and you know, that was, you know, the first real opportunity. So I worked that summer, but that first day on June 6th, someone asked me the other day, "Do you remember that day?" It was downtown, 17 Clinton Avenue South, what is now probably that plaza by the I should know the new name for Chase Tower, but it escapes me.
Oh, yeah, gotcha.
But that's where the station was. I remember going in there and very quickly going out with a black and white film camera and covering stories.
Nervous or excited?
Yeah, I mean, both. Yeah. I mean, yeah. At that time, we had not a full newscast. Channel 13 had signed on the air. It was a relatively new station. They decided early on not to directly compete with a 6 o'clock news. So they ran Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin talk shows back to back. They had big billboards with Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin standing back to back. They ran those in the afternoon and covered the other competition at 6. At about 7:15 or 7:20, they did a weather forecast, Jerry Carr. And at 7:25, we did a 5-minute newscast. So I would go out sometimes and do an interview and go home and tell my parents, that arm holding the microphone is me. Yeah. I mean, and I was that excited to see my arm on television, you know, let alone anything else. You know, eventually we expanded the newscast and then and did more at 11 o'clock. So I had a chance to be on a little more. But that early stage was that exciting, just to be there and be part of it and be able to share that was really exciting.
That's so. I love that story about that hand is mine. I remember my first job was a podunk little radio station in Ohio, in my hometown, and I remember telling my parents the imaging that comes between two songs, you know, the Kiss 102, and I remember telling my parents, like, I put that there.
Yeah.
I'm the one who put that there in between those songs.
Like, I can remember. This really sounds, you'll enjoy this one. This came to mind when you said that. It was, I think, during the riots in 60, we had some riots in 62 and 64. And I was in master control at the time. And at that time, we were feeding film video to NBC to carry live across the country. I was in master control. I could control the shading. You know, and I didn't do it very much, but I could just twist a knob and it would get a little brighter or a little dimmer. And I did that just enough saying, I am controlling
the whole nation.
The whole nation.
That's awesome. I would do that same thing.
I've had this input, but I think that's probably an extension of what it's all about.
Yeah,
We have that, you know, we know we're reaching people and we're reaching a wide audience, but you don't often think about the massive audience. Yeah. You think about the individuals you're reaching one by one.
Back in those days, Don, late 60s, right? Mm-hmm. How did you guys just live and die by the ratings back in those days?
Yeah, it was more important, I think, than we think about it now.
Okay.
And I was going through some files on my desk just yesterday because I have to clean out some of those. And there are many folders that have ratings from different periods. So whenever those ratings would come out, we would pay, you know, very close attention to them. There was a time when someone suggested, and we didn't take them up on it, that maybe we used to have talent fees. Mm. So you'd get a base salary. Ironically, when I worked those summer engineering jobs, I made $95 a week, mm-hmm. which wasn't bad. On the radio, I made $1.50 an hour.
Yeah.
So when I was doing summer engineering, I made $95. When I came to Channel 13, I was making $75 a week. It was a $20 pay cut.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, if you did a newscast or you did a commercial, you would get what they call talent fees.
Yep.
And the talent fee, as you remember, if you did a newscast, was $14.70. I don't know why they came up with that. But there was a time when they said, what if we make the talent fees a percentage of the commercials?
Hmm.
And they never did, but we often thought, boy, if that had, if they'd done that and it was true today,
yeah,
we would have retired many years ago.
Don, when did you know that you had made it? Not just that you got the job, but that you had gotten to that level of you were going to be able to do this for the rest of your life. You were good at it. The ratings were reflecting that. Yeah. People liked you. Like, when did you go, I'm safe now. I can do this as long as I want.
You know, I don't... You know, sadly enough, there probably wasn't that moment until I got older. Because we went through many ownership changes.
Yeah.
I can remember, and I can't remember the exact company, I can remember sitting down with a general manager and working out a contract for a new, you know, new contract. And before we signed it, the station was sold. And the new owner said, no way.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to accept this.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the general manager at the time saying, well, if, you know, to the current company, if you're going to pull this contract back, you're coming to town. I'm not going to tell them. A vice president from out of town flew in. We went to lunch, and they very politely said, look, we're selling, and we can't guarantee. If the new people like you and they want to keep you, it's up to you to negotiate with them. And that happened to some degree, either officially or kind of unofficially, every time we changed owners. We had probably eight or nine owners from the day that I started at Channel 13. The last owner, by the time they took over, I was a little older. As I became older, it was more established, and I think they tended to realize that just having him there has some value.
Do you remember the first time I get this? This might be too, and you can just say, like, I don't want to talk about that. But so it's sort of the same question, but do you remember the first time you signed one where it was a little bit life-changing, where you went, this number will put me in a different position in life?
You know, that,
you remember that one?
Yeah, that one I remember. I remember.
How many years was that? I still have
in my files the pencil.
That you signed that one with?
We didn't sign the contract, but Vince DeLuca, God bless him, rest his soul. Vince DeLuca was a great general manager. And at the time, it was the Marriott Hotel over the hill. It's now the RIT Inn and Conference Center. And we went over there for dinner one night. And we were ironing out my contract. At that time, WHAM Radio had approached me. I don't know if Jack Slatter, he had retired. Anyway, they wanted me to do the morning show, and they made an offer that was more than I was making on television.
They got your attention,
and that got my attention.
Yeah.
And I really didn't want to leave television, but it gave me the first opportunity to say, "Hey, this is what somebody else thinks I'm worth."
Yeah,
and that probably was the first significant advance. There were some others from other television stations in town over the years that were enabled to do that. You know, it always took someone saying, you know, hey, and I would also approach it that way. I don't want to leave, but this person thinks they're willing to pay me this to do that. So that probably advanced me at times to where I felt I was, you know, a little more comfortable than I'd been. Because the business traditionally and even today isn't as high paying as most people think. Most people think, oh, you're in television, you're rolling in money. That doesn't happen. And we're seeing the struggle now with young people. They come into this now as a young reporter, and they want to do this. Yeah. They want to be a journalist. They want to tell stories. But it's not the kind of wage that they can be comfortable with for the rest of their
life. They have second jobs.
Yeah.
A lot of them have second jobs. Yeah. I was one of them. Yeah. I get it. Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's sad in a way, but it's, you know, the business is changing. As I said, I've had that window that we talked about, the bubble I was able to ride. And we're seeing that now where linear broadcasting is dropping down. Digital is coming up. Mm-hmm. Podcasts like this are becoming the way that people listen to and get news. And they get it off the phone. So it's a different kind of broadcasting environment than we've seen in the last 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
Welcome to Behind the Studio Door, where we dig into the vibrant creative landscape of Rochester, New York. Hi, I'm Molly Darling, and along with my co-host Christian Rivera and our fabulous producer Chris Lindstrom, it's my pleasure to guide you through the dynamic world of our local creative professionals. Each episode offers a unique glimpse into the studios of those who enrich our Rochester community with their artistic vision. Join us as we explore the diversity and talent in Rochester, revealing the compelling narratives and creative journeys that exist just beyond the studio door.
I'm Chris Lindstrom, the host of the Food About Town podcast. If you want to learn more about the Rochester food and drink scene and beyond, with a good dose of nerdery and personal stories on top, then Food About Town is for you. I've been writing and podcasting for over 10 years, and I'm so thankful for all the support from the community. Subscribe to the Food About Town podcast today and hear from the people that make and love the food and beverages you can't stop enjoying.
What was it like for you? Just let's talk mid-career, even recent. Mm-hmm. Like, what was it like for you then? You've become, and I don't even know if you know what I mean by this, but I think you do. You've become now, you're Don Alhart. Yeah. You're the guy, right? But you're still covering the news, mm-hmm. which means occasionally you're going to do stories that piss people off.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. You're covering the guy who's in the scandal or yeah. whatever. What was that like balancing being a journalist
yeah.
and a celebrity at the same time in a relatively small town?
Yeah.
Was that ever tricky or?
I think I was talking about this the other day with someone that said, you know, we've never really known politically where you stand at all. So I've always had that, I think, a sense of saying, my job, I'm that town crier from years ago. I tell you what happened today. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't be telling you my opinions about it or what happened. That said, it isn't always easy to tell some stories. I can remember going to a parent-teacher conference years ago for one of our children, and the teacher was very awkward. And I couldn't understand why. And even our relationship between our child and that teacher was awkward. Turns out that teacher's child was killed in an accident years prior. And she remembered me announcing it on the news.
Oh, yeah.
And that, you know, so every time she saw me, it was a reminder of the child she had lost. I think that made it, you know, that always was something I remember saying, I can't change that. I had to tell the story. And it always brought me back to Dick Burt. Dick Burt and I co-anchored for 20 years. We worked together for 20 years. And there was a day when we were in a meeting and he was interrupted, and they pulled Dick out to say his son had been struck by a car. He had climbed up on a snow pile waiting for the school bus, slipped off the snow pile, and fell into the path of a car. He left that meeting. We all were in shock. The next morning, his son died. And that was probably the most difficult moment I've ever had on the air. I said, I'm going to open this newscast, and all I'm going to say is Dick Burt's son was struck by a car yesterday. He passed away this morning. I said, I don't think I can say any more than that. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go to commercial. It was a strange request. Tom Wells was doing weather on one side. George Bain was doing the sports, sitting right next to me. They weren't usually on the set that early, but they were there. We opened the newscast. I barely got through that. We went to commercial, and they both reached over and just held my hands mm-hmm. and said, you know, we knew when the commercials were over, I had to come back and yeah. do the rest of the show.
Yeah.
And that was always tough, because when Dick finally did return to work, and I was, back then we didn't have producers, I was producing the show, I would always, for a while, make sure I read the stories about kids and accidents or things, because I didn't want to have him have to read that. So I guess, you know, with that in mind, I'm always very sensitive when I'm reading a story, and I tell this to the reporters, tell that story as if the family may not be watching if it's a tragic event, but they might be. Mm-hmm. And so when you read that story, when you deliver that news, deliver it as if they were in the room, because they may be, or they may see that later. And that's going to be what they remember. And the sincerity and the emotion that you show at that time is going to live with them forever.
You guys, I mean, the reporters who are on the street, all of you guys, deal with people while they're still so raw with the emotion from the thing. Yeah. I mean, what has that been like over the years of interviewing somebody who just experienced this thing? And sometimes maybe that thing was a great thing, and that's easier, I would assume, but sometimes it's a terrible thing, and now you're sticking a microphone in their face. I mean, what is that like? How do you manage to be a journalist, a human at the same time? I feel bad for this woman. She's just lost her child, but at the same time, she's the story. Like, what is the strategy?
You know, Kayleanne Polton, Jenny Ryan, and I, you know, went to that service when they had it at the convention center at the time, and thousands turned out for it. The convention center was packed. We were up in that rim looking down on it. But we had to talk to, and I remember Jenny most of all sitting down with Kaylee Polton and talking to the mother of Kaylee Polton at the time, and you just have to have that compassion in your heart. I tell that to the reporters now. You have to put yourself in their position when you're talking to them. You know, so often, and I think our news department, I know, and probably others as well, are very aware now of even minor things. You go to the scene of an accident and don't show the license plate, because there may be someone at home that hasn't had time to even hear about their loved one being in an accident. They see a car that looks similar to a car they were driving. There's no need for us to, if the car's flipped over or whatever it is, don't zoom in on the license plate. Don't show it.
And can I just say, what you're saying right now is so important for people to hear, because we talked about technology, Twitter, podcasts, that kind of shit. The social media, they don't edit anything.
No,
Somebody will be raw on the scene of an accident. You guys are vetting that and thinking about what you're talking about right now. But the people with the phone in the hand, and then the access to social media, has created some bad turmoil of what you're
it's
discussing.
It's probably almost a weekly, if not daily, occurrence in the newsroom where people say, we have this video, but if we're going to use it and have permission to use it, watch out for the language that's in the background. Uh-huh. I can remember years ago, this goes back, now again, I'm dating myself with film. When we used to shoot film, the sound on the film eventually became a magnetic stripe, so it was like a recorder. But in the very early days, our first sound cameras, the audio portion on the film was optical. So, you know, there was a video point, there was a picture frame, and then the stripe along the side was a little audio track, very much like an audio you see on a computer now, the wavelength. I can remember covering the mafia trials with Frank Valenti. And when he came out of the court, he just, every expletive you could say, he would let out. So, to use that film on the air, you had to go into the edit area, find on the video, you know, that little strip exactly where he said whatever he said, and take a little piece of tape, quarter, you know, and just cover it with tape. Well, you didn't get them all.
Yeah.
You would try. You get, that's kind of a thing. Yeah. And, you know, but that's how we had to cover. So now, of course, now you got it all. You just have to do the best you can, and you can do it electronically.
Have you ever been sitting at that anchor desk before and you guys aired something and you're like, oh my God, that just went out on the, like, if you, a curse word or something?
There must be some.
It's got to happen over the years. We had one or two on the Weeze show over the years.
Yeah.
Where something got on the air that I'm going, oh my God.
And most of the time, you know, most of the things that got on the air are what things we could laugh about.
Yeah.
I can remember once it was, I still have a clip of it. Jane Flash, bless her, and she'll chuckle about this if she hears it, but Jane was anchoring and Bill Peterson was doing the news. And when you're anchoring, sometimes you know, it's awkward sometimes just to make that transition from news into weather. I mean, even now, sometimes, you know, producers will write something. Well, you know, it was raining today. Well, look, here's Scott with the, you know, you want to do something informal. You want to make it casual. So Jane is reading a story about the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And, it had been leaning. I guess they were firming it back up in this video of this. And the story ends. It comes out to her and Bill Peterson. And she very innocently turns to him and says, and now to a man whose Pisa never leans. Well, Bill gulped. He took a gulp and went, what? and Jane for a moment had that look like, what did I What did I say?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was just making a little transition. Yeah. Of course, Bill, you know, I guess it's the old French saying, "Honi soit qui mal y pense," evil to him who evil thinks.
Yeah.
So maybe the burden was on us that, you know, we heard a different version of what she was saying. But moments like that are the ones that, and you can't take them back if it's live. So you really enjoy it.
So you're a Guinness World Record holder. Yeah. 58, right?
58 years? 57, I think, is the actual Guinness record. It'll be 58. I don't know if we'll change it. I hope we change it. But.
Yeah. Yeah. You're staying on the air till June?
June 6th.
June 6th. You're going right off June 6th. So it'll be exactly.
People talk about that. But I see, you know, I guess they know that. My life is very structured. People know that. My daily routine is pretty much the same. I said, you know what? I started on 6-6. I think, you know, 60 years would be a little bit of, I mean, I'm going to turn 80 on May 15th. So I said, you know what? I'd like to do a newscast when I'm 80 years old.
Yeah, cool.
And I'd like to round it out on the day that I started. And I think that kind of put it in perspective for me. I said, you know, how many people, you know, and there probably are people over 80 still on the air somewhere, I'm sure. But that just seemed like a...
So how long ago,
you know, don't
did
push
you...
it too far. You know, yeah. you get to that point, you say, all right, I can keep going. Then something happens, and I look back and say, why didn't I do this sooner? Yeah. Just like downsizing or right-sizing a house, you know.
Yeah.
Trying to be a little bit ahead of it if you can.
Well, how long ago was it that you made that decision in real life? I know you announced it publicly, but when did you actually say, out loud, I would imagine, to your wife, is probably the first person to say, I think this is it. I think I have
the plan. You know, we did the last contract I did expired at the end of last year, 2023. And that was, I think, I was very grateful. I remember when we did that one, the general manager, Chuck Samuels, said, what do you want to do? And, you know, that happened too. That happened between one of the ownership changes, because the last ownership change before this current manager, the owners had said, We just want you to do the 6 o'clock news. We don't want you to do the 11 anymore, and we don't want to pay you as much as we've been paying you. Basically, that's where it was. And then the station was sold. So I approached that, and that was probably, how many years ago? But we approached that, Mary and I, saying, well, this is the start of retirement. I was in my 60s at the time, or 70s probably by then. So we said, that seems to be the way things are going. So now new owners come in. And I sit down with Chuck and I go, well, you know, this is the understanding we had with the previous owners, that I'd step back from the 11, just do the 6. And he said, well, I talked to the new owners and they said, what do you want to do? What does Don want to do? I said, well, Don's pretty happy doing what he's doing. I just soon keep doing it. They go, okay. And that was it. And even when we came up to the last renewal, and I remember Chuck talking to Mary, because she would sometimes get more information out of him than I would. Mm-hmm. Women can do that. Mm-hmm. At some event, and he said to Mary at one point, it's up to Don. Whatever Don wants to do, it's his call, which meant a lot to me.
That's huge.
And I think that kind of put it in perspective. So when that last contract was going to be up at the end of 2023, I don't know if I'd said, hey, I just keep on doing this, if they would have, I don't know.
They would have. It sounds like whatever
sounds
you
like they would have. Yeah. So I said, you know, let me be the one. And if I'm, you know, I'm going to, and I did. I just did that quirky little math. I'm going to be 80. Sit down. That'd be 58 years, 60 years. Go for another two. You know, if I look back on a broadcast career in Rochester, it really began in 1962 with Channel 8. Mm-hmm. So I've already gone 62 years in Rochester broadcasting. Yeah. And what do those numbers really mean when all is said and done? You know, they're going to put that on my tombstone. He did this for 62 years. I don't think so. So I said, you know what? There's a time to really put life in perspective and do other, you know, as I was at a home recently giving a speech. And my speech was more, it was a senior living facility. I said, I'm here to speak to you, but I'm really here at this phase of my life to learn from you. And two or three people came up. One lady in particular, I remember, she said, don't plan too much for retirement. You will be surprised how busy you are. And I'm already looking. I was looking this morning. Someone asked me to MC an event in September. And I said, well, I won't be on the air by then. I'll be forgotten by then.
Oh, right.
But they'll still want me.
Right.
I said to Mary, should I do that? She goes, yeah. You know, it might be good to know you've got you know, got that event coming up. So I think that really kind of
so
puts
are you
in
are you telling me you really this is not a 5 or 10 year plan? You knew you it was just this last holiday season.
So yeah, so probably toward the end of that contract, it was probably a year ago, a year ago.
Okay,
when we kind of said, you know, our contract's going to be up at the end of the year. What do we want to do?
Okay, yeah.
And I remember Mary said, "What do you want to do? You, I mean, your contract is done. You can be done." I said, "Well, I want to keep going, but I don't know if I want to go a whole year. You know, another whole year." And the business has changed. I mean, the business has changed. Staffing has changed. We've gone through, I mean, when I look at the staff in the newsroom, if I go back a year, there's probably only 4 or 5 people that really I've connected with. Reporters are basically new. Producers are turning over. It's a different business, and that presents a challenge. So I said, you know, not that I'm discontented with the way things are, but it's enough of a change that I'm thinking, all right, maybe that's time. And I look at the young people that are anchoring now and say, you know, at some point, you got to get out of the way. You know, I mean, selfishly, you can keep going. But at some point, there are other people that want those opportunities. And so that I think that's part of the equation, too, saying, you know, it's like there's an old saying, and I can't remember, but the guests that stay too long, like fish.
Yeah. By the way, let me know when that becomes me. By the way,
no, that's right. But it's that. You know, at some point, you walk in and you look around, and you know the reporters could have been my children.
Yeah.
Now they could be my grandchildren. Yeah. I mean, they really could.
Yeah.
If I'd married a little sooner, so it's like. This is about time.
You've given so much of yourself to charities. Mm. I mean, Rotary is a big thing. One of the last things I want to talk to you about is Rotary, and I'll get out of your hair. But in general, you've given so much of yourself. All the things you MC, all the things you show up for. How have you over the years? I mean, God bless Mary's heart, to tell you the truth, because she just is okay with you being gone on a Friday and a Saturday and a Sunday. Yeah. Has she ever reined you in and been like, Don, I need you home. I need you home sometimes.
No, I don't think so. You know, really? In fact, I've dragged her the other way. I remember when we first did the United Cerebral Palsy Telethon, UCP came to me and said, you know, John Ritter and his wife and Henry Winkler and his wife, I had a chance to meet him a few years ago, it's a husband and wife thing. And so we'd like to have a husband and wife do the local telethon. Would your wife do it with you? I said, I don't know. Let me ask her. So I asked her, and she said, well, let me think about it. Well, in the meantime, they called back and said, what did she say? I said, yeah, we're good.
Yeah.
And then I kind of let her know that she'd committed without. And that was a challenge, but boy, she did very well. We did those for many years, and it brought the family on. Where was I going with that? Because we were...
I was just asking about if Mary...
Oh, Mary, yeah.
Yeah. She gives you shit for not being home.
No. Very, very supportive. I think she knew that early on. I think she knew Rotary was going to be a part of our lives. And that was a big part of the timing life. I mean, Rochester Rotary, as you know, becoming president is not just a one-year job. It's a couple of years of preparation. Mm-hmm. And then once you've done that, you're the go-to person for other things. Mm-hmm. And when I got involved in the district and asked by our club to apply to be district governor, we had a long discussion, probably the biggest discussion we had. And it was Mary who finally said to me, what will you regret more, that you did it or you didn't do it? And I thought, well, if I knew I had a chance to do it, maybe I'd regret that I didn't do it. And so we went ahead on that. Well, that's a 5-year commitment by the time you go. And she had to go with me to training in California, and always has been very supportive.
Yeah.
That support has kept me, and that was always a challenge, especially raising kids, because I was working that night shift. I'd be the father that got to the Little League game at the bottom of the 3rd inning and left at the top of the 5th to go back for the 11 o'clock news. I was there. I made the effort to be there, but it was always that the burden of of raising the kids really fell more to her because of that.
Yeah. You know? But you got mornings though, right? I mean, you were here for get them on the bus, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Drive them to school. Like, you know, you were always there for that. So that had to be special.
And and that, although a lot of times if I worked till midnight, I probably sleeping in a little bit. And that was on days for a while when Wanda and I did the morning break show. That was probably one of the most fun times. And if I look back on a whole career, that was because we were live at Marketplace Mall. We had Carol Channing, Jesse Jackson, Mitch. We had, it was, and you really had a chance to see the people you were communicating with. I always tell that to reporters even now. You have any advice? I said, yeah, go to the mall. For what? I said, just sit in a chair at the mall and watch the people walk by. And think of them when you're telling a story, when you're reporting a story, because that's your audience. That's the people. You know, it's not the journalists. It's not the people that are going to say, oh, that was well written. No, that's not your, I mean, we want it well written. We hope your grammar is good. But that's not who you're talking to. The people that walk by you at the mall as you sit in the chair are the people that you're talking to when you tell a story. And tell it as if you were just talking to them in the mall. Don't read it. Don't be formal. Talk to the viewer as if you were talking to the guy in the mall or the girl in the mall that is walking by. I said, that's the main advice that I can share with you.
Yeah. I need advice from you now. Rotary, let's talk. Yeah. You're a former club president. You mentioned you're also a former district governor, which people can Google what that means, but they could probably figure it out. I'm incoming president next year. It's only a couple months away at this point. I've been going around talking to as many past presidents as I can. You're one of the last that I'm talking to. I haven't talked to Bud. I mentioned Bud Rudzinski. Yeah. He's like the one I haven't talked to.
He will be good. You'll appreciate him very much.
Can you give me some personal advice on how to be the Rotary Club president? Because I'm self-conscious about it because all the presidents before me seem like they're more full of wisdom. They seem smarter than me, more qualified. I don't know how I ended up in the role. I'm honored, but I'm here.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Hey, the one piece of advice one of the past presidents gave me, and this is back in 1987, and it really was something I carried with me and I think will help. And he said, it's 1 year. This is a club that has existed since, 1905 or 1911 we were chartered. Rotary existed 1905. You can't mess it up in 1 year.
He said, right.
You can't mess this up in 1 year. And that being said, that means don't be afraid to do some new things. If people don't like it, you'll be done a year from now.
True.
And it goes very quickly.
Right.
So, I guess in a way saying, don't take yourself too seriously. But it's, he said, you can't mess it up. The club will survive. We'll move on. So, try some new things. Be aware of what people, there are, and it's always very tough because you look at a club like that. I can remember when I joined Rotary, every Tuesday we were down at the Chamber of Commerce, a beautiful large hall, immense head table. And I loved head tables. I still love to MC when there's an MT, a whole head table. And one of our presidents came along, Tom Mees, years ago, and he did away with a head table. I was devastated. I said, "This, you can't do away with a head table.
Right.
This is Rotary. We have a head table." I don't think I've been to a head table in the last 5 years. I adjusted to it. So there will be some people that have traditions that you may tread on a little bit. I can't think of many right now that would be that precious to anyone.
We've become a lot more informal over the years.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that has helped. And the membership has changed, too. So it's I think we see that on at Tuesday meetings. It's a more relaxed atmosphere. It's not that formal, ring the bell, everybody stood up at attention. And, we've relaxed a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the world today. We really need to relax. We need to, but we're still doing the same things. And that's the important thing. And I think probably the biggest challenge I would look at is to let people in the club know what Rotary is. Because I think a lot of people join and they aren't fully aware. They know it's a service club. They know we have a wonderful camp that serves children with disabilities every summer out in Rush. They've heard about it, but they may not have experienced it. Your theme this year, the Magic of Rotary.
Magic of Rotary.
And that takes me back. Matt Adams was a president of our club. And he had, in addition to, and we haven't done it as recently, but each president used to kind of have our own little theme. Mine was spread the sunshine. And I had pens made up that I handed out. My whole year was spread the sunshine, meaning talk about our Rotary Camp, spread the news about Sunshine Camp. I was doing public relations back in 1987. Matt Adams, his little slogan was share the magic. And what he meant by that was, don't just talk about the Sunshine Camp. Don't just go to the Sunshine Camp. Live there for a day. So I took him up on the challenge. I took him up on the challenge with a crew from the station and a live truck as well. But I'm going to spend 24 hours. I was assigned a young man, little kid, Flip Palizzi. And he has cerebral palsy. And he was my responsibility for 24 hours. I slept in the cabin with him. At that time, you know, because they had CP, if he needed a diaper change, and you're talking a fifth, sixth grader, you know. When we went to the mess hall, I had to help feed him because he didn't have the arm motion to do that. But I lived for 24 hours at that camp and had the luxury, too, of reporting on it at the time. But I shared that magic, and I really understood what our counselors go through, what campers go through every day. Flip and I are still friends. I've visited him at Monroe Community Hospital over the years. I've got to visit him now because he finally has a home, bought a house. I mean, great. Brilliant computer guy. I mean, he can build a computer, not physically with his hands, but mentally he can tell you what to do. If he types a message to you, and I have videos of him, it's a headband that he uses with a pointer, and he will move his head to touch the keys on the keyboard and type as fast as you or I can type. Because that's what cerebral palsy is. It's a motor challenge. It's not a mental challenge. But he's still a friend, and I had other friends. I've lost a couple over the years, but the friendships you make, and when you totally understand what that camp is, that's I think is a good challenge too. Don't just talk about your camp. You know, it's not, I belong to Rush or Rotary. We have this great camp. You ever been out there? Well, no, but I pay my dues and I write. Yeah. No. You know, we want your money. Yes, we want your dues. We want to sustain the club, but we want you to know what that is really all about. And I remember that. I mean, I remember when it was down in Durant, Eastman Beach. I would go down with my dad, who was in Rotary. And that was the core of Rotary. It was, you know, we would go and paint the cabins. And my father had a hardware store. He'd supply the paint and the brushes. And Bob Buckbit ran a boiler company. He would take care of the hot water heaters. And Jim Isaac would make sure the plumbing, the heating was going. And it was, you know, not always money. It was time and talent. And I think that's what I learned over the years. I may not have always had large amounts of money to contribute, but I can give my time. I can give my
talent,
opinions and my talent. Yeah. Whatever, you know, find your own niche to members, I'm saying. Tell members, you know, what do you want to do? What do you want to do for this? What can you do for this club? You know, we don't want everybody doing the same thing. We want to know what your unique talents are. Maybe that's what you challenge people at a first meeting. Tell me your unique talent, the one thing that you think makes you different from anybody else. And let's find a way to use that to do good in the world.
Don, we had Roland Williams. I know you know the NFL player. He was our speaker at our Big Brothers Big Sisters gala. And he said something that I'm going to borrow for my year as president, which is you just talked about. Yeah. And I'm so glad you said it. And that is there's four things that you can give to a charity. You can give your time, your talent, your money, or your network.
Yeah.
I'm just asking you, can you give us one of those four things?
Yeah.
Give us one of those four things. We'll take any one of the four.
Yeah.
They're all so valuable. Yeah.
And when you look around that room, and you know, we used to have a lot more people would come to a Tuesday meeting. Times have changed.
I know.
But you look around that room, and they're good people. I always tell people, I just sponsored a new member. And it was the best part of it is I didn't go out and look for a new member. I walk with this guy on the track every day, as you know.
I interviewed him.
Yeah. I walk with Joe Cutter on the track every day. And somehow, in our conversations, I must have talked so much about Rotary that he wanted to know more about it. And the more I talked about it, and again, it's his fit. He's in landscaping and snow plowing, but his landscaping knowledge can help us. He's already looking for ways that he can help. He was inspired by, you know, and all I was doing was talking about Rotary. I was not making a sales pitch. Right. I was not looking for a new member. I didn't know if he'd have the time or inclination to even join a Rotary club. But he approached me saying, what do I have to do to become a member? And it woke me up to what, you know, what he can bring to our club. And I think he'll be a great asset.
He will.
There are people, you know, like that, that have talents and abilities that probably are hesitant because they think, you know, what can I do? And they don't know until they get there. But you look around that room, as I'm telling my other point, you look around that room, and I always look around and say, these are good people. They would not be here. They would not be part of this group if they didn't want to help others.
It's a room full of volunteers.
Make life better. You know, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, yeah. All right, but I mean, this is too much time. I'm sorry I took so much of your time. But are you telling me you play guitar? There's a guitar.
I did, yes. I have, I haven't picked that up in a while, but in high school, we had a group, the three Ds, Don Alhart, Don Fleshman on drums, and Dale Selke on the lead guitar. Thank goodness he was lead guitar, because all I ever really could play was the chords. But yeah, we did, and then we had another group, One Eyed Jacks, I think it was we called. But we actually did some gigs, played at a couple of clubs, and played some college fraternities when we were still in high school, and you know, had some fun doing it. And you know, music is always that's a whole nother topic. But I think music is such an integral part of our business, of the communication business.
Yeah,
the ability to just the rhythm and pace that goes into music is something that goes into broadcasting, goes into a newscast. I've been blessed now with a producer that her mother's a church organist and a music teacher, and she is full of music. And every time we put a newscast together, it's like a musical selection. Yeah. And that's why the Bright Spot is kind of our ending every day that you know, brings it to a conclusion.
You know what I did want to ask you? I did want to ask you one more thing. How do you say no? You do so many things, but I imagine there's stuff you say no to because every charity in town wants you to MC their thing, you know, whatever their thing is, and every charity's got a thing. How do you say no? I am so deathly afraid of saying no because I don't want them to get mad at me and go, oh, he said no to us, but he did that other thing. How do you say no?
I don't think I've said no all that much, and that's what's probably kept me a little more busy than I should be. And a lot of times when I say no, it's because we have a family obligation or some other event. Somebody asked me to do something, and I said, oh, Mary's having cataract surgery that day, so I can't be there for that. I better be around for that. But it's interesting. I mentioned that one event in September.
Mm-hmm.
It's an organization that I did not know existed. I know nothing about it. But Perry Bradley is a member of Rochester Rotary. And he came up to me on a Tuesday meeting and said, after you retire, are you still going to MC events? I said, probably. He said, well, I have a friend, a neighbor, who's looking for an MC for an event. I said, just have him send me an email. He sent me an email. And I turned to Mary. I said, I don't know what we're doing, but it's a Saturday in September. I said, but Perry, it's a friend of Perry Bradley's. He said, well, then you should do it.
Yeah.
You should do it because a friend of yours in Rotary, a good friend in Rotary, is reaching out to you on behalf of a good friend in his neighborhood.
Yeah.
So those are always the connections, and you just kind of say, yeah. Now, you know, at some point, your calendar may fill up, but my challenge is going to be now. I don't have the excuse saying, gee, I'd love to do that, but I'm on the air at 6 o'clock and I can't be there for that 5 o'clock reception. My challenge is going to be now. I can't. You know, I'm going to have to be a little more.
You're still going to get careful. Requested a lot, Don. Yeah, I mean, I have a hair of what you have, and I still get requested. And I haven't been on the radio in four years, so thanks for doing this, man. I really appreciate it.
This has been fun.
This is really cool. It's an honor to even know you, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Don. And by the way, that coffee cake, Mary made coffee cake. That was fantastic. You buried an Italian lady. You did that right, Don.
I did. That's the one thing I did right in my life. That's for sure.
Thank you, Don.
This has been a presentation of the Lunch Hour Podcast Network.